Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, cultural enrichment, and all-inclusive fares. Discover more at viking.com.
This giant field has chipmunks, geese, perhaps a few skunks and snakes. It's honestly hard to tell in the bramble that's taking over. I'd call it a ghost town, but there's no town left, just a clue here and there of what used to be. A basketball hoop peeks out from a patch of vines, a pad of concrete, once a driveway. Street numbers spray-painted on crumbling pavement. Without buildings, these roads seem to lead in circles. But the thing that stops me in my tracks is the New York City no parking sign. 5 years ago, the aftermath of Hurricane Sandy tore through the city that never sleeps. While most other scars are starting to heal, this Staten Island neighborhood called Oakwood Beach quite literally rolled up the sidewalks with bulldozers. But why leave a New York neighborhood for dead? The latest technologies are helping us study hurricanes like we've never studied them before. Yet, however far we advance with prediction, no amount of technology will prevent the storms themselves, and we have many more questions than answers about how best to apply our efforts. Do we sacrifice neighborhoods like Oakwood Beach to protect other parts of coastal communities? Do we pour resources into fortifying and raising houses, or might technology help us find a way to coexist?
This is the future of everything. A look ahead from the Wall Street Journal.
From the newsroom in New York, I'm Jennifer Strong, and this is the future of everything.
Every couple hours, I was opening the front door and just checking to see how close the water was.
Hurricane Harvey sat over Texas for days, dumping 50 inches of water into some neighborhoods and resulting in at least 90 storm-related deaths.
I'm Holly Hartman, journalism teacher at Memorial High School in Houston, Texas.
Sick of watching the news, Hartman went on Facebook.
I was just looking at Facebook and I saw a post. They were talking about this app Zello and how it was helping people get rescued in the Houston area who were trapped in their houses.
She heard people calling for rescue as water poured into their homes. First responders were far outnumbered, and volunteers had organized their own relief system using Zello. It's an app that turns your phone into a walkie-talkie.
They said, who's here that can kind of stay through the night, because it was obvious it was going to get really busy as the situation started getting worse in South Texas. So I just tapped on the button and said, well, I can help if somebody can tell me what to do.
Just like that, Hartman had joined the Cajun Navy, a motley crew of volunteers armed with fishing boats and smartphone apps working to save her neighbors from rising floodwaters.
You ask, how many are there? Children, elderly, pets? What's the situation? Is it imminent danger? How much water?
Hartman stayed awake for 34 hours. Most of the people she talked to eventually made it out, but some didn't, including a family who couldn't swim and a couple of teenage boys who died trying to help others. First responders are trained to deal with this kind of trauma. Hartman is not.
I'd never, ever really experienced anything like that before, so I stopped a few minutes and really thought, you know, should I really be doing this?
She later wrote about the experience on Facebook, and the post went viral.
The number of deaths would have been much greater without these volunteers, especially these men in the boats who were actually going to do the rescues. The first responders here did an amazing job and worked for a week nonstop, but the Houston Harvey Rescue database said that they logged, I think, 7,800 rescue requests.
This episode, we're looking at the role of technology in a landscape we can't control. Hurricanes. We start with people pushing the boundaries of weather forecasting. Scientists with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, called NOAA, are boarding a military jet in Florida. They're called hurricane hunters. This particular flight flew into the eye of Hurricane Maria to release experimental drones called coyotes.
We are getting ready. We will launch in a few seconds. You'll hear a sound. That's the chute opening, and then we're going to be launching. Ready?
That's meteorologist Joe Cione.
Watch the wing.
These drones give us data about what's happening inside a storm.
Good. All right. So just look at that 8 knots. You'll know when you get in the eye wall. It'll start increasing, obviously.
There's long-running debate over weather models. European forecasts are typically more accurate, and drones are one of several things U.S. researchers hope will improve their models.
I'm Tim Marchak. I am a research meteorologist at NOAA's Geophysical Fluid Dynamics Lab in Princeton, New Jersey.
Princeton is the birthplace of modern forecasting.
Here at our NOAA lab, we do a wide range of research, all the way from climate change research to ocean modeling to atmospheric modeling.
There are inherent challenges to hurricane research, including that the subject itself is deadly.
It's not like we're doing research on how to better grow tomatoes, where we can go out into a field and there are 1,000 tomatoes. Number one, there aren't that many hurricanes. And number two, you can't really safely get close to a really strong hurricane.
And that's where the drones come in.
Another unmanned platform that we have is a Global Hawk.
That's a larger vehicle that can fly for 24 hours, reaching heights of up to 60,000 feet. There's also a new satellite called the GOES-16.
This GOES-16 satellite is important because, number one, it's always there. It's what's called a geostationary satellite. That means it stays above the same spot. But what's terrific about GOES-16 is that it quadruples the resolution of the images over what we currently have. It sends the data back at a much higher temporal frequency. So instead of having images of a hurricane 4 times an hour, we now have every minute or every 30 seconds.
That means scientists can watch the real-time fluid evolution of storms such as Harvey, Irma, and Maria.
If a storm increases its wind speeds by at least 30 knots or 35 miles an hour in 24 hours or less, we call that rapid intensification. And it's very difficult to forecast because some of the features that are responsible for rapid intensification occur on such small scales, currently below the scale of what our models can represent.
He says that will change as they move to new, higher resolution models. But for now, these innovations are still being tested.
I'm Robert Lee Hotz. I'm a science writer at the Wall Street Journal. I specialize in covering basic research of all sorts.
He says we're in the middle of a revolution in terms of how we turn our sensors and technical eyes to Earth.
Traditionally, we build these huge satellites of the size of Greyhound buses. They cost billions of dollars. And particularly in the case of NOAA, they are typically years and years and years behind in their launch schedules and things. And this has actually, in recent years, caused something of a crisis in coverage. Well, that's been building to the point where Congress felt obliged to pass this act this past spring, which President Trump did sign into law.
He's referring to the Weather Research and Forecasting Innovation Act.
It would be an understatement, perhaps, to say that there are a lot of people who now think that the U.S. climate forecasting system stinks. It is significantly less accurate than European global weather climate modeling systems. In fact, it's so far behind that I'm told that there are portions of the United States Air Force actually now use British weather forecasting software in their work.
With NOAA funding and leadership unclear, so too is the future of U.S. forecasting. President Trump tapped a businessman to lead NOAA, Barry Myers, the chief executive of AccuWeather. It's a position typically held by a scientist.
Understandably raised all kinds of questions, political questions about potential conflicts of interest. But I guess what I'd like to point out is, in a way, we're looking at this through the wrong side of the mirror. The best data now is starting to come from private companies.
And Hotz says forecasting is a much more cooperative venture than it was a decade ago.
So this is Mary Glacken, and we're here today in Andover, Massachusetts.
After 35 years at NOAA, Glacken directs science and forecasting at the Weather Company.
Let's take a little walk over, and I'll show you a little bit about what we do in the Weather Company. One of the things that we do with our forecasting technology is we basically use all of those model runs, and we do a dynamic machine learning on top of that.
She imagines a not-too-distant future in which anything could be turned into forecast data.
Taking data off of automobiles, anti-lock brake, how often is that being hit? That tells you something about road conditions. How often your windshield wipers are moving? That tells you something about rain intensity.
The company is owned by IBM, and it provides weather solutions for businesses.
We're sitting in front of an aviation desk here, and you can see the icons up here are airplanes from some of our clients. And on each of those aircraft, we're pulling off data in real time. So all of a sudden, you have a really rich data set of observations.
But Glacken says the real payoff isn't in nailing a forecast, it's in helping make decisions during extreme weather situations.
Whether your decision maker is a family in Houston, or whether your decision maker is Walmart. You really need to be able to tell them specifically about impacts, assess possible outcomes, and then you need to be able to update that in real time.
The weather company is experimenting with social media bots as one way to keep people informed.
One could imagine having an app with the official hurricane track or the hurricane forecast, but it would actually be showing you what the flooding potential was at your location, so you could see your dot where you are, just like your Uber app, where you can see where you are and where the Uber car is coming. And I think that would be really a game changer, that people would have at their fingertips really actionable information in ways they haven't before and have it updated in real time.
It could give people more time to evacuate, but leaving isn't always an option.
In Florida, at least you're on land, right? In Puerto Rico, you're on an island, isolated. It's hard to leave. You can't really go in the sea because it's just not safe. And flying may not be an option for you because you have no money.
That's Daniela Hernandez, digital science editor at The Wall Street Journal.
That only gets you so far, right? Because even if you left and you survived, your house, your business, that you can't evacuate that. That's there.
She covered the aftermath of Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico.
The particular location where I was at had a convergence of four catastrophic events. So you had a really strong surge of the ocean. You had a river on the other side of the town that overflooded. So those two sources of water collided. And then you had the rain and, of course, the winds.
Congress is pledging relief money, but even in the best of circumstances, rebuilding is a long, hard process. And Puerto Rico is $70 billion in debt.
When I spoke to the Secretary of Economic Development and Commerce, he admitted that Maria had been catastrophic for the island on every level. Every sector of the economy was affected. At the same time, he and others almost see this as an opportunity to build Puerto Rico back in a more sustainable, greener way. They want to make investments into science and technology because they see that as the way to dig themselves out. And they already have capabilities in that sense. They have a strong pharma presence. They have a good university system.
When a hurricane destroys an area, residents face a nuanced web of questions. Will insurance cover the damage? Should the focus be on fixing things quickly, or on building back in a perhaps slower and more expensive way that stands a better chance against future storms?
This home will be officially designated as a fortified home.
Leslie Sism covers insurance for the Wall Street Journal. We're in Breezy Point, New York, a small beachside community in Queens that's faced these very questions.
And here is another house that's been lifted, but not quite as high.
In this 500-acre enclave, sounds of construction fill the air.
So we're approaching a house under construction that is being built with state-of-the-art materials and state-of-the-art construction techniques.
People here have been restoring their homes since Hurricane Sandy in 2012.
The roof has been attached in a certain fashion, is strapped on, bolted on in a way that's going to be very resistant to strong hurricane winds, and other techniques through this house make it as resistant as we know now how to make houses to storms.
And several factors are helping.
Breezy Point is a many decades old close-knit community. These homes were originally little bungalows, just modest sized properties. It has been home to a lot of firefighters and police officers. Families have passed these houses down from generation to generation. They were very determined to rebuild. So a lot of other places, especially in the Caribbean,
Puerto Rico. A lot of the damage there will take a long time to rebuild because it doesn't have some of the advantages that this place had in being able to tap into that private sector insurance money and the know-how of the community and getting things done.
Still, the business of hurricane preparedness is one of what-ifs, never guarantees. And while this hurricane season isn't so unusual on the grand scale of things, you're not alone if you're sensing we've seen more severe storms this year than in recent memory.
I made a little list here because there were so many.
Science writer Lee Hotz.
Hurricane Nate was the fastest moving storm ever recorded in the Gulf of Mexico. Irma was the strongest hurricane ever recorded in the Atlantic outside the Gulf of Mexico. The highest number of hurricanes with winds of 75 miles or more since 1893.
And while we can't control when and where hurricanes hit, Hotz says, at the very least, we can change how we prepare.
No matter what kinds of storms lie ahead, what we can say is that our population is growing. I mean, the amount of land that human beings need and take up is expanding, and we like to live in the paths of these storms. We like to live along the coast. We like to live, Lord knows, in Manhattan. But we can start to understand that water seeks its own level. And Manhattan's a good example of that. If you look at the flooding maps in Hurricane Sandy, by and large, the natural shoreline, the ancient shoreline of the island, was dry. And those places where we have expanded our footprint, landfill areas, did get severe water damage.
He says we can learn to adapt to an environment's natural patterns.
The Dutch, for instance, who perhaps more than anyone in the world have been thinking about this because, of course, their land is one huge reclamation project taken back from the sea. And in recent years, they have come to understand that they can't build their walls high enough. They have actually started to engineer ways to accommodate periodic high water, because in the case of the Dutch, they don't just have to contend with rising seas, but of course also with more intense periods of rainfall. They're like the storms that were for half of Europe. It's a different way of thinking about how we develop these coastal areas. It's coexistence rather than resistance.
The Future of Everything is a production of The Wall Street Journal. The show is produced by Laura Sim and Martha C. Daniel. John Wardock is the executive producer of WSJ Podcasts. Stan Parrish is the editor-in-chief of The Future of Everything. We had help with this episode from The Wall Street Journal's Christopher Mims, J.R. Whalen, Lee Hotz, Daniela Hernandez, Leslie Sism, Mike Miller, Jennifer Hicks, and Larry Root. Thanks for listening. I'm Jennifer Strong from The Newsroom in New York.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.